And I'm going to mute every one of you.
Bye.
Bye. So unmute yourself if you want to talk.
Bye.
Okay, so you all should be muted and the recording should be on. Let me just make sure that it is. Yes, it is. So this past week is and I hang on a minute. I'll do that in a minute. I got to shut off my emails because they keep dinging during the talk. So this past week has been a difficult week in a lot of ways. I mean, obviously, with the passing of Betty Doss, with the election results that we saw, with the chaos that was in Washington this past week, all of the things that are happening today, the resurgence of the COVID virus, the new strain of it that seems to be getting around, all of our friends in some level of personal crisis or health issues. It's just important that each of us understand where we are and try to make the best of where we are and try to do what God has called us to do. I'm going to bring up and share my screen now because I want to talk about a couple of things. As we start, this should come up here in a second. All right, so we have gone through a set of lessons with the Christmas story. We've gotten back into Corinthians, and we're going to do Corinthians chapter 9 today. And you can see the schedule kind of for the rest of the month. Although I am going to do a probably in case you missed it next week for a few minutes, talk about some of the things that are going on that I don't want to do today. Because they're not finished developing. I want to let them get it develop a little further, and then we'll talk about them. But so that's where we are. We're going to continue to do the Zoom calls for as long as they're needed. I guess that'll change at some point, but for right now, we're going to continue to do those. So those of you who are not coming or don't feel like you can come now, I want you to understand that we're going to keep doing those. Our daughter sent us a little thing, which I thought perfectly sums up the year. And it says, I'd like to cancel my subscription to 2021. I've experienced the free 7-day trial and I'm not interested. I mean, I realize we're on day 10 now, but the first 7 days of this year have been momentous in many ways. And I think that's kind of a, you know, people are always full of gallows humor, so to speak. You know, it's always in the darkest times, people can make light of them. And you know, we still can laugh about a few things that are going on. And I think we all feel this way about the year so far. You know, we're seeing the beginnings of a move to global establishments. We're seeing whatever you want to call it, the deep state or the administrative state or whatever name you wish to call it. We're seeing that begin to take its revenge on everybody, and not just President Trump, but on everybody that supported him, on the 72 million people that voted for him. And we're going to see that for a while. They are not happy with defeat. They want to annihilate all of us. And that's a sad place to be in America, but that's where we are right now. And so I do think free speech, we're seeing that. We're seeing censorship already. And some of the big tech platforms have the perfect way to do that. They just cut you off. And if they don't cut you off, Apple cuts you off, and then Google cuts you off. So you can't even get on the platforms to speak. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. I do think they will get their comeuppance sooner or later, and that new platforms will arise and new methods for people to express their opinions. The First Amendment has not died. It's been shot at quite a bit, but it's not dead yet. And we just need to be aware of that. And of course, this group of people fears no retribution because, you know, they've got the main establishment with them, the press is with them. If they don't like what somebody's doing, they just won't cover it. And even if something bad happens on that side, they will make it look like it's not bad, you know. So this is a whole topic we could talk about a later time, and we probably will. That's going to be some of the things I'll talk about. But I also believe you're going to see, we haven't started seeing it yet, But we are going to see a rise of anti-Semitism. We're going to see that as well. And that's particularly galling in America. But we're going to see it here. We see it in other countries. But surprisingly, Israel is leading the world in vaccinations now. They've had their troubles, but they've got over 1 million people vaccinated now, and they'll have their whole country vaccinated within another month or so. So they're pretty amazing, and when they're focused on things. And so that's going to be a subject of conversation. You know, did they get too much vaccine? Did they not get too much? Did the world, you know, not get enough so the Jews could get vaccinated? We're going to see all those stories play out. So just be expecting that. I guess I had a talk with Pastor Jeff when he went up to do part of Betty's funeral, and he's wrestling with the same phenomena going on. And I think, we're going to see some of that in some of his messages, because I think he's concerned about where we are and where we go. And I think he'll give us some needed guidance, and I'm excited about that. I guess all I would say is whatever comes, whenever it comes, God is still on his throne, and we will get through this to the glory that awaits us. You know, we are children of God. We are citizens of the kingdom. We may live in Cumming or Dawsonville or Georgia, but we're really citizens of God's kingdom, and we're just residing here. So we need to keep that back in our mind. President Biden said we would have a dark winter, and I think he was referring more to the COVID situation. But I mean, if you read the news, you see the storm clouds, you hear the thunder, the lightning is happening off in the distance. And so we're going to see that. I do have a video, by the way, that's about 4 months old. I have hesitated to send it out. I did send it to our family, but it's by Dave Reagan. It's Lamb Lion Ministry. And it's his year-end summary of where we are in the timeline of the of God's plan. I will send that out. I know some of you are very interested in that subject. Some of you are not interested at all. And so if you're not interested, just don't watch the video. But it's important to get it out so everybody who is interested can see it. It's about, I don't know, 15 or 20 minutes long, maybe. And he recorded this back in, I think, September or October, kind of a year-end review. So it's interesting for you to look at, and I'll send that out to everybody. I know some of you are not interested, but, you know, God has given us prophecy in the Bible, not so we could ignore it, but so that we could understand it and be prepared for what comes. We need to understand that the evil is coming, but yet we come through on the other side. And that's important for all of us to understand. I'm going to go back now and get into our study of Corinthians. And I know that these chapter 8, chapter 9, and chapter 10 are all going to be a little different lessons, but they're all regarding questions that Paul was asked by the Corinthians in a letter we no longer have. And it's always a little problematic to read an answer and try to determine what the question is. Some of them are easier than others. In chapter 8, Paul was answering a specific question that the followers in Corinth asked him about eating meat that had been offered to idols. And we don't do that. I mean, it's not a problem for us today. So we don't have that particular situation. But the general answer he gave is important for us, because I tried to set the stage for why that was a problem then, and Paul's answer, and how we should approach that. But the general answer and the higher level answer that Paul gave is one that we all can take to use in those particular areas of our culture that are in what you'd call gray areas of the gospel. And I made specific reference to a few of them, you know, that depending on where you grew up in the country and, you know, what was acceptable and what wasn't. And for the record, I don't take drugs, smoke, drink, chew, or go with women that do. You know, I don't do any of that stuff. So, but I was trying to make a point that cultural things that we do, sometimes we question whether they're within God's will or they're not. And the whole discussion last week was about the knowledge we have of what is and what isn't in God's will. But more important than that is the the position as Christians with some level of wisdom, what we do when we get in that situation. And Paul's answer, and I'll read this in 1 Corinthians 8, and then we'll move on to 9. It says, "Be careful, however, that the exercise of your rights does not become a stumbling block to the weak." And again, weak conscience he uses here, and it really means those who cannot resist the temptations that are around them. It doesn't mean your conscience is weak. It just means you can't, if somebody does something around you, you'll fall into that same behavior. And so he says, so I'll read all of it. I don't want to skip it around. "For if someone with a weak conscience sees you with all your knowledge eating at an idol's temple, won't that person be emboldened to eat what is sacrificed to idols?" And again, that's the point about if we do things that we understand from our understanding of scriptures are fine, but somebody else is bothered by that, will they fall into some trouble because of it? And he says, "So the weak brother or sister for whom Christ died is destroyed by your knowledge." That's pretty strong. He says, "When you sin against them in this way and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ." So you doing whatever you're free to do is not a sin against Christ, but the fact that you knew somebody had a problem and you went ahead and did it to their detriment, that's the sin against Christ. So it's important. And he goes on to say, "Therefore, if what I eat causes my brother or sister to fall into sin, I'll never eat meat again so that I will not cause them to fall." So I guess the point is we should always consider the consequences of what we do, even though we may be free. And I reviewed, I'm not going to go through all these, but John MacArthur had this whole set of things, questions he goes through in his mind if he's trying to decide whether something is worth doing or not. And you can read those and you can look at them. There's two that I think are really important. One of them is, this what Christ would do? You know, people were wearing these "what would Jesus do" bracelets. I think that's important to understand if Christ would do what we're contemplating. And the second one is it really the right thing to do? Is it the right thing to do in love for our brothers and sisters? And these are the things we can use to gauge what we're going to do. And I think if we follow that, we'll be doing well, and we'll be discerning what is right for us in certain situations. And Paul makes a point about situational concerns, and we'll see that in chapter 9. So we're going to move to chapter 9 now. This whole discussion is about freedom, you know, freedom to do things, freedom to not do things, your rights as a believer, you know, what are your rights? The people in Corinth were very big on rights. It's getting like we are today. You know, people say, "Well, I've got a right to do this." Well, it still may be a stupid thing to do, but you may have a right to do it. You know, you can go jump off the bridge into the lake, and that may be you may be free to do that, but it may not be the smartest thing to do. And that's the balance that we have to strike here. But Paul comes back now to make a point about his own freedom, because there's another question they ask him in this letter, which I think he gets to very quickly here. And that is, what is his right to be an apostle? And also, what is his right to get paid or not paid as a member of the clergy, if you will, or whatever? And we don't deal with that so much today. Although I'll tell you, if you've been in small churches, what the pastor makes, what the staff makes, if it's a bivocational pastor, what they make, you know, if you don't know what that is, that's somebody who has a real job and then does their pastor work as a sideline. They preach on Sunday, they, you know, visit and do all that, but they may be a plumber, an electrician, or a carpenter, or whatever, much like Paul was a tent maker. So those discussions do go on, even in today's church, but, you know, people like the Southern Baptist Convention and others offer guidance as to what a pastor should make and how they should be paid, and, you know, depending on the area of the church. A very wealthy church is different from a struggling church. A church with 10 staff members is different from a church with one or two staff members. All of that comes under the guidance of, you know, how do you be a steward for the money that God has given you? And that's important. Paul begins this address in chapter 9 by saying, "Am I not free?" In other words, is Paul free as a Christian? They want their freedom. They want their rights. Is Paul free? Am I not an apostle? This is to answer that question. Have I not seen Jesus, our Lord? Are you not the result of my work in the Lord? So understand that most of the apostles were disciples first. They ministered with Jesus during his lifetime. Paul was not that way. But yet Paul was selected by Christ himself to be an apostle. We know that on the road to Damascus. We know that in some of the things we read in Luke and Mark and some of the other things about Paul's call to the ministry. And of course, one of the key things about a call is there fruit being born? Is the fruit of this make it clear that this person is saved, this person is called? And the people in Corinth were the result of his work in the Lord. So he asked the question, he sort of lays the answer in front of them. He said, even though I may not be an apostle to others, so to all these other people that aren't in Corinth, he may not be an apostle, but surely I am to you, because they were the result of his work. For you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. I think that's important. You know, everybody ministers differently. You have evangelists, you have, you know, pastors who stay in a flock and work for years, you know, shepherding the flock. All different people have different calls, and they're all part of God's kingdom. They all have a mission and a plan to do. And he's saying, look, other people may not think I'm an apostle. I mean, Paul wasn't, he didn't like John come and minister in Ephesus for many, many, many years. He planted churches. He visited them a couple of times. He wrote letters back to them. But his charter was to get churches set up and witness to Gentiles. And that's what he did. And so they are the seal of his apostleship. And he says, this is my defense for those who sit in judgment on me. So you get the idea that in this letter that they were judging him. Is he really an apostle? Is he not an apostle? Most of this is borne out in the fact that there were so many Jews that had come into the religion. And you remember Paul and Barnabas and a few others were really big on two notions. One is the grace of God, that they got to where they are and you got salvation by grace, not works. And the other one is, you know, all of the laws of the Old Testament, if you become a Christian, you do not have to become a Jew first to become a Christian. You become a Christian because you're freed from the law. And a lot of the Jews who had become Christians hated that about Paul. They wanted to diminish his ministry. And so everywhere he went, he was dogged by people that followed him and tried to sow discord in every single fellowship he was in. And he says, this is my defense. Don't we have the right to food and drink? In other words, don't we have the right to eat and drink? And if we come visit with you, don't we have the right to do that? Don't we have the right to take a believing wife along with us? Interesting. As do the other apostles and the Lord's brothers and Cephas. So Cephas is Peter. So he says, don't we have a right? Now, they didn't take believing wives with them, but don't they have the right to do that? It does kind of give you interesting pause to think about the Lord's brothers who are in the ministry, and that's James and Jude, and also Peter. You know, many people believe they were married, you know, how this all worked, but it appears like they may have taken their wives with them when they did whatever they did. Then he says, is it only I and Barnabas who lack the right to not work for a living? He's going to come back to a couple of Old Testament passages in a minute, but he's basically saying, you know, some of these others come and you feed them and you give them drink and you help them along their way. You know, you do things for them. Don't we have those same rights? Don't we have the right as an apostle to do that? And he comes to make a couple of other things. Who serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard and does not eat the grapes? Who tends a flock and does not drink the milk? Do I say this merely on human authority? Doesn't the law say the same thing? For it's written in the law of Moses. This is in Deuteronomy, by the way. I thought I had that up here on the screen, but it's in Deuteronomy. Let me look it up real quick. Deuteronomy 25:4. is that verse that says, do not muzzle an ox when it is threshing out the grain. You know, we understand that as an ox would move the millstone and walk around in a circle, and the grain drops to the ground. You don't muzzle the ox so he doesn't bend down and eat a little grain as he's going. And that's the point here. And then he makes the point is that what God's concern is? Is he concerned for the oxen? Well, probably the answer is yes. But he also says, surely he says this for us, doesn't he? And I think this is Paul's way of saying, you know, think about the scripture and think about what the scripture says and try to make a higher level application, you know, other than just oxen. Isn't this for all of us who serve? He says, yes, this was written for us because whoever plows and threshes should be able to do so in hope of sharing in the harvest. If we have sown spiritual seed among you, is it too much if we reap a material harvest? If others have this right of support from you, shouldn't we have it all the more? You'll hear, I can't tell you how many times I've heard preachers preach when, you know, when it was the new year and it was time for the budget and their salary was going to be presented in the Sunday evening service. They'd always preach about, you know, don't muzzle the threshing ox and two or three other things just to remind people, you know, of what the Bible says. But he says, but we did not use this right. This is important for Paul. On the contrary, we put up with anything rather than hinder the gospel of Christ. If you don't know, and you probably remember this, but Paul was a tent maker. So everywhere Paul went, he worked making tents, and he earned his living making tents. So his food, he paid for. His travel, he paid for. His lodging, he paid for. All of his trip expenses, he paid for, because he earned the money as a bivocational pastor might. But that doesn't make it wrong for him to be paid. He just chooses not to do it. And I think this is kind of a throwback to chapter 8. It may be right for him to do that. It may be right for them to pay him, but it's also his right to choose not to take the money. It's also his right to choose not to hinder the gospel. And in a very small church, you know, you look at the budget and there's really two items that make up 90% of the budget. And that's staff salaries and mortgage payments on the building, you know, utilities. And then there's only 10% left for ministry generally, which is a shame because the primary reason they're there is for ministry. But, you know, and it's the smaller the church is, the more difficult that is to do. And so he just said, well, fine, I'm not going to take any money. I don't want any money. You, whatever money you have, you use it for ministry. I'm not going to take any of it. And I think that's really a positive for Paul and how he dealt with things. It's kind of an interesting parallel. I mean, the church is in a much different place than it was then. But he goes on in the next set of verses to say, he reminds them of two things. If they're Jews, he reminds them of the temple worship for the priests. And if they're not Jews, he reminds them of the pagan worship that they have. Don't you know that those who serve in the temple get their food from the temple, that those who serve at the altar share in what is offered on the altar? In the same way, the Lord has commanded that those who preach the gospel should receive their living from the gospel. So if you have thrown your lot in with the Lord and you are fully committed to serve and you're serving in a way, then Paul says, if that's your full-time deal, you should get your living from the gospel. Now, Paul would also say, don't buy a Mercedes Benz and don't buy, you know, an airplane if you can't afford it, you know, all that stuff. But, you know, here's the thing. You live within the means of what's provided for you. And if you're following the Lord's will, that's what you'll do. He says, but I have not used any of these rights. And I am not writing this in hope that you will do such things for me. Don't get me wrong here. I'm not asking you for this. I'm just telling you it's right. He said, for I would rather die than allow anyone to deprive me of this boast. Then he goes on. I think one thing you can say for Paul, Paul had his opinions. Paul had his plan. Paul had his call. He had his mission. And there was nothing or no one going to stop him from doing what he thought was right. And whether it was jail, whether it was, you know, dying from the Romans, whatever, he was going to do what he thought was right. He says, "For when I preach the gospel, I cannot boast, since I am compelled to preach. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel." I want to read the next verse, and then I'm going to make a comment on both of them. "If I preach voluntarily, I have a reward. If not voluntarily, I'm simply discharging the trust committed to me." What is he saying here? He's saying there's a difference between a call and a job. If I have a job setting up the internet at First Redeemer Church, I get paid money for what I do. And every day when I go to the pay window, if you will, and I get paid, then we're square. I've worked, they've paid me, we're square. But a call is different than that. If somebody has a call to the ministry, then they're going to do what they do regardless of what they get paid or how they get paid. They're not going to switch from this. They're not going to move from First Redeemer to another one down the street because they'll get a dollar an hour more. You know, that's not what a call is. You feel a call to preach, and that drives what you do. It's also a call to be a youth pastor. It's a call to be a deacon. It's a call to be a business administrator. It's a call to be in women's ministry. There's a call that we have. And there's nothing really more damaging in the church than somebody who's doing the job of a pastor without a call. They're doing it as a job. They're doing it to make the money. They're trying to do the best they can to make money. Without the call, it's so evident. And Paul is not saying that. He's saying, "I am called. And I don't want anybody to take away the fact that I'm doing this, not being paid for it. I'm doing it because if I don't do it, I'm dishonoring my call. I'm not doing what God has called me to do. I woe to me if I don't fulfill my call." Verse 18, "What then is my reward? Just this, that in preaching the gospel, I may offer it free of charge and so not make full use of my rights as a preacher of the gospel." So his reward is that he preaches the gospel with all of his heart, and he preaches it knowing full well he's doing it as a volunteer, not because he gets paid. And for many people, the idea of getting paid for something they want to do for the Lord is a problem. You know, people will give money to the Lord, and many times they'll do it quietly. They don't want notoriety. They want to do something, but they don't want the world to see what they do, because that's not why they do it. And Paul is that way here. He makes this comment that he doesn't want to use his rights because he wants to be able to volunteer and to be able to know that that's, he's given his service because he needs to do it. He wants to do it. He's called to do it. So I think that's an important point he makes. And all of this is about his freedom. And now let's take a look at how he uses his freedom. This is the next set of verses. "Though I am free and belong to no one, I have made myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible." These verses that are coming up are interesting verses, and we've heard them. We've heard people quote them. We've talked about them. But I want to share a little bit of light on them as we go through that maybe makes them a little clearer into what Paul had in mind. He says, "I've made myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible." Two things here. Paul has made himself subservient to everyone he ministers to, because his goal is to minister to them and win as many as possible. It's clear that Paul understood that not everyone will be saved. We know even in Jesus's time, when he went back to Nazareth to preach, and he preached, and all they could see was, "This is Joseph's son. Isn't he a carpenter? You know, weren't it brothers? Didn't they help build his table? Didn't they build this house?" They could never see him for who he was. And so he left, couldn't perform any miracles there except the healing of people, because nobody believed. That's the same with Paul. It's also the same with us. We will minister to people. We will talk to people. We will pray for people. We will do all sorts of things to get them to make the decision to come to the Lord. But we got to understand that's not going to be reality for everyone. And that's just, our job is to do what we can, to whom we can, whenever we can, and leave the results to the Lord. And that's what Paul's saying here, to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, as to win those under the law. So when he witnessed to Jews, he didn't flaunt the fact that he was not under the law. He went along with their ceremonial law, washed his hands, you know, many times before they ate, all the ceremonial laws they had. He did that because he didn't want to offend them in that way. He wanted to be able to talk to them about their soul and where it was going. So to win those under the law, he became like one of them. Verse 21, to those not having the law, I became like one not having the law. That's interesting. So when he witnesses the Gentiles, he doesn't do all of the Jewish rituals because he's free not to do them. They don't expect them. It doesn't offend them if he doesn't do that. He says, he makes the point, even though he's free to do that, he's not free from God's law, not ritual law, by the way, but he is under Christ's law. So he's still under the law of the Lord when he witnesses, but he's just not under those. When he says the law, it means the Old Testament, the ritual laws that are in the Old Testament. He says, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. I have become all things to all people so that by all possible means I might save some. This is not license to do whatever you want in whatever group you want. It is a way to say that you don't have to perform all the ritualistic things that you do because your main goal there is to witness. And so you don't want to offend them. You don't want to get their mind off of what you're there for. You want to become to them what they will accept to hear somebody talk about the gospel. Doesn't mean you water down the gospel, by the way. It just means you do it. And these are some of the words that are used for things like seeker churches, you know, where people come in and they're going to act different in a seeker church because their audience is a seeker church. The point though of that, and I don't want to get off on a seeker church dialogue here, but if you think about a seeker church, in many ways, it's like a marketing company. I was in marketing for 30 years. In marketing, you look at your customers, you decide what they want, and you tailor your message to what they want. Well, we don't do that in a church. We don't survey our customers because our customers are really lost souls looking for the Lord. And what we want to do is we want to teach them the gospel. We want to bring them into the fold. We don't want to just make them happy churchgoers. We want to bring them into the fold. And so Paul is not saying that. What he's saying is, you know, I preach the gospel, but my point is I try to act like the people I'm talking to in the sense that I don't offend them by doing Jewish things or if I'm with Jews, I don't eat meat that has been offered to an idol, or I don't do some of the other things. It's kind of an interesting thing, but it all falls back on the gray areas of how we act and what we do. And again, what would Jesus do? What is the right thing to do? I think that's really the question we get to. Verse 23, I do all this for the sake of the gospel that I may share in its blessings. So he does that because his goal is to minister the gospel. And the interesting thing here is that by ministering in the gospel, by doing what God calls him to do, by presenting the gospel, he shares in the blessing of the gospel. And I think that's an important thing for all of us. If we're doing what God wants us to do, we'll be blessed by him for doing it, because that's what he's called us to be and to do. But there's a matter of self-discipline, and he deals with this in so many ways. In many of Paul's letters, he uses athletic metaphors, you know, running the race and doing that kind of stuff. And he uses one here. He says in verse 24, do you not know that in a race, all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. In other words, you don't have to win the prize, but you need to run the race in order to win the prize. And by running the race in order to win the prize, you've done what you're supposed to do. All the runners run. You know, if you're in the race, you run, and some compete and some don't. And some, you know, some may come in dead last. And we all see these heroic YouTubes where the guy falls and gets up and drags himself across the finish line, or somebody comes in and lifts them up and helps them walk into the finish line. They didn't finish first, but they finished. And they had a lot of self-discipline in doing that. Then he goes on to say, everyone who competes in the game goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last. In other words, they go to get a crown of garlands or some kind of a prize for winning the Olympics. And of course, in this culture, the Greek Olympics